Hello, I'm Luke Broadwater, and I'm a Maryland political reporter for the Baltimore Sun.
And I'm Leah Cromer, a pollster and political science professor at Goucher College. And this is Roughly Speaking, Government Edition, a Baltimore Sun podcast where each week during legislative session, we take a closer look at the policy, people, and places that shape our state government.
This week, we're going to be talking with Delegate Nick Mosby of Baltimore and Senator Mary Washington as they talk about some of the legislation they will be putting in this upcoming General Assembly session. We actually visited with them at a church on North Avenue where they were discussing legislation concerning a very important issue for Baltimoreans, and that is water bills. We will also be discussing each week not just the legislation, but the things that have been in the news, the policies of the governor, etc., that you're paying attention to, and we hope you pay more attention to in Maryland. But first, I wanted to give a little thanks to Dan Rodericks. He's, I think, the longest-serving columnist maybe in America. He's been writing his column at the Baltimore Sun for 40 years. And Dan was the host of this Roughly Speaking podcast for several years at the Baltimore Sun. He's done a tremendous job. He's going to be stepping back a little bit to do some more longer writing and to focus on his column. And in his place, Dr. Cromer and I will be coming to you each week throughout the General Assembly session to keep you up to date on Maryland politics and Maryland lawmakers. We hope to bring other aspects of the newsroom into Roughly Speaking very soon, but for now it's going to be Maryland politics all the time. And with that, let's move on to our discussion. All right, and we just got some new poll results, fresh poll results from pollster Patrick Gonzalez. And he did both the issues, some big issues that will come up this year at the General Assembly, and also the favorability ratings for both President Donald Trump and Governor Larry Hogan. Let's start with the issues. One thing that jumps off the page to me headed into a session where this likely will come up is a majority of Marylanders want marijuana legalized. What do you think about that?
So I think this is really consistent with what we have found at the Goucher poll in the past. It's, you know, right just below that 60% mark for Marylanders statewide. It's particularly high, who would have guessed it, among those individuals who are young. And it gets a little bit lower among those individuals who are 55 years of age or 65 years of age or older. But interestingly enough, they're starting to creep up to a 50% mark for those older Marylanders. And what Mr. Gonzalez finds here in his poll is really consistent with what we've seen nationwide. So Marylanders look a lot like Americans in general. It's a nationwide push towards the legalization of marijuana.
Yeah, we've seen many states go to it now. I think I saw something that said, what, like a third of the country or a fourth of the country lives in states now where marijuana is legalized. And part of that's because California is so big.
It's a normalizing thing. And so, like, as you mentioned, that Americans are now, you know, waking up in states that have legal marijuana. It's that, and it's medicinal marijuana. I think that as you age, certainly you're faced with some really sort of tough diseases sometimes. And more and more you see Americans sort of turning to medicinal marijuana as a way to medicate, you know, during a cancer diagnosis or something like that. And it's become increasingly more acceptable. It's losing a lot of the social stigma. And so it's not really surprising that you're starting to see that number sort of creep up among even older Marylanders.
And this is likely to pass or at least be debated some this year and perhaps go to the voters next year. We know it will probably be a referendum in Maryland. Another thing that may be a referendum, and it also, I think, is motivated by some of the same impulses, and that is raising revenue, is sports betting. What did the Gonzalez poll have to say about sports betting?
So, but we don't have a clear majority yet on sports betting. And so the Gonzalez poll asked if they'd like to see sports betting legalized here in Maryland. It doesn't quite have a majority yet, but more individuals support sports betting than don't support sports betting. But interestingly enough, they followed up and asked Marylanders whether they'd like the legislature to decide or whether they want this put on the ballot. And an overwhelming majority of Marylanders say, no, the voters should decide whether we approve of sports betting here in the state.
And it was, I think, what, 49% were in favor of sports betting?
Yeah, so 49% of Marylanders say that they are supportive of legalized sports betting versus around 36%, and mid-30s say that they are opposed to it.
You know, I've always wondered, in a state where you have legalized casino gambling, legalized slots, legalized lottery for many years, I mean, it seems almost inevitable that we will have legalized sports betting. And we have Speaker Bush in favor of it. We have, I think, Senate President Miller in favor of it. We have, it seems, Governor Hogan is saying like, we can work something out. The issue, I think, for Miller is more of a protocol issue about when do you pass legislation in the year it goes on the ballot, or can you do it the year before that?
Well, so I think this is also interesting in the larger conversation about the delay of the Curran Commission. So obviously Curran comes with a significant price tag, and what they're talking about here with legalization of recreational marijuana as well as legalization of sports betting are revenue generating and really taxable sort of programs. And so that would be interesting, I think, certainly with the delay of Curran and the price tag associated with Curran, if we don't see a push for these more kind of net revenue generating programs.
And that's right, the Curran Commission, as we and please read all about it in the Baltimore Sun, is recommending a $3.8 billion increase in school funding. And now, of course, bringing it home here, the poll also asked about Donald Trump's approval rating in Maryland and Larry Hogan's approval rating in Maryland. How did they stack up, each of these two Republicans, and how do they compare historically to their previous poll results?
It's like Donald Trump and Larry Hogan are living in two completely different worlds in Maryland. So Trump's approval rating actually has ticked up a little bit from the last time the Gallup poll asked about him. It seems like a lifetime ago, back in September. It's up to 34% of approval rating. We had him in the 20s, so it's up a little bit. Disapproval rating still really high, and it's almost universal disapproval among Democrats. The opposite is true for Governor Larry Hogan, the second Republican to ever win re-election in Maryland. His approval ratings are high again. He's hit 70, and it's almost that high. I think it's that high among Democrats as well.
How did Trump do among Maryland Republicans?
So that's, I think that's the, it's interesting. He still does quite well among Maryland Republicans. And that, I think, becomes the most interesting disconnect. So Republicans at the same time really love the governor, who has taken great lengths to distance himself from the president. They like the governor and they like the president.
Yeah, they still approve of Trump by 81%. So that your average Maryland Republican is not an anti-Trumper by any stretch. And then the 77% job approval rating for Larry Hogan, the governor, that seems to be very high. Is that the highest we've seen him?
Oh, I didn't realize. Oh, gosh, now I'm glad you pointed it out. I didn't even realize it was at 77%. That is the high. This is the highest mark he's ever been. That's an astronomical number. Like, there's no way to slice and dice this. There's nothing negative about having a 77% approval rating. And right, among Maryland Democrats, he has the Gonzales poll finds him at a 70% approval rating, only 25% disapprove. It's at 86 among Republicans and 88 among unaffiliated voters in the state.
Clearly, there were a number of people who voted for Ben Jealous over Larry Hogan who still liked Larry Hogan.
Right. And so, but we've seen that gap persistently sort of like over time, right? There was always that support approval gap that individuals really like Larry Hogan. But the same percentage who approved the job he was doing didn't say they were going to vote for him. But enough, certainly on election day, did end up voting for him to give him a 14-point victory. But sure, you're going to have, I think Maryland Democrats, by and large, the reason you're seeing that 70% approval rating is they do reward the governor when he does distance himself from the president. And with a disapproval rating of President Trump among Maryland Democrats hitting 90%, that's essentially no Democrats in the state approving of the job the president's doing, but 70% approving of the job that the Republican governor is doing.
It's a fascinating dichotomy there between those two Republicans. And with that, we're going to go ahead and move on to the interviews, and we're going to head up to North Avenue in Baltimore to catch up with Senator Mary Washington and Delegate Nick Mosby.
But Senator Mary Washington, so first for our listeners, can you describe your district, the people and sort of the places? And so how would somebody know if they were driving through, if they've arrived in your district?
So you arrive in the 43rd District once you cross North Avenue heading up Charles Street, and then you could, if you wanted to head over, hang a right, head over up by Hartford Road, go all the way up to the county line, kind of make a little divot there through Hamilton, run across the top of the county line all the way back down to Charles Street, come straight down, you'll cross, on your right you'll see Mary Our Queen on the right, on the left you'll go past College of Notre Dame, or what was the College of Notre Dame, but Notre Dame University, Loyola, and then you keep heading right back down, you hang a right down University Parkway, go all through Hamden, swing back through Remington, all the way down Falls Road, you're going to go along down Falls Road, past the Subway Museum, and then you're going to hike back up the stairs, back up to North Avenue. And so I represent the communities of Waverly, Northwood, Edner Gardens, Charles Village, Able, Pering. We've got four parks. We've got parks in our universe, our district. We've got four universities. We've got Morgan State University, as I said, Loyola, and Notre Dame University of Maryland. Johns Hopkins University is in my district. Again, we've got a golf course. We've got Lake Montebello, if you've ever gone to ride around Lake Montebello. We've just got a beautiful mixture of row houses and mansions and storefronts. One of the most economically, racially, culturally diverse districts in the state and in the city. And I believe we represent what is best about Baltimore. And we also have a community that I believe is emblematic of those committed to addressing our challenges and living through them with joy and a type of pragmatic optimism that I like to characterize a lot of us.
Okay, wonderful. Okay, so I'm going to ask you a couple questions about yourself. So you were the first openly LGBT African American elected official in Maryland. And the most recent, and in your most recent election to the Maryland Senate, congratulations, by the way, occurred during a year that some have called a rainbow wave. So according to Andrew Reynolds, he's a political scientist at the University of North Carolina, the previous record for gay and transgender people serving in state legislators was around 119, so throughout the whole country. It's now up to 129, so that's a little bit less than 2% of all state legislators nationwide. So do you see yourself as a role model and an advocate for future LGBT candidates, particularly those who are African American?
When you're someone who... I guess I've been called a trailblazer when you're someone who's the first. I didn't really plan on being with the first. It was just looking at it to do the work. But I believe that that's part of the responsibility, and I'm asked that. And I'm so honored that I'll be the first out woman to be elected to the Maryland Senate. We've already had a man, and now I'll be the first woman. And then combined with that, the first African-American. And there's only, I believe, two of us across the country. So... you know, I've benefited from people who are willing to put themselves out no matter who they are or because of who they are. And I hope that I'm part of the cohort of people that no matter what is happening at the federal level, what's happening globally, can say in Maryland and in some communities across our country, love wins, that it is the content of your character. To quote a very old mantra, that should be what is elects you to public office and allows you to serve. And I want to make sure that the young people behind us know that that's the case and that they can take up that fight.
So what do you think that the Maryland Democratic Party can do to encourage more LGBT candidates to run for public office as Democrats?
Well, I'm really excited about the upcoming class of people that have been elected to the Maryland General Assembly, also to our State Central Committee and the Democratic Party. And I believe that across the board, whether we're talking about having more working class people running for office, where we're having more women running for office, where we're having people who identify as LGBTQ running for office, that the party, all we have to do is to look at our constituents and to really advocate that anyone who believes that they have a call for service. But also what we have to do is make it a little easier. We have to invest. We have to recruit. Multiple studies have shown that men often volunteer themselves more often for service than women. Women need to be asked, that we've been socialized to wait our turn. And too many people, in the leadership of our party they've done well over time, but there is this culture of waiting your turn. And for so many of us, we said the time is now to make the changes. And I believe the party knows that, and that we're going to see some differences in the upcoming years.
So my last question before I turn it over to Luke. So you're a sociologist, and you have a PhD from Johns Hopkins University, and you're a former assistant professor at Lehigh University. You did that job for 5 years. So can you tell me just a little bit about your research interests, and what drove you to leave academia full-time to really be a policy advocate, and then eventually run for public office?
I know it might sound corny, but I decided that I wanted to help make the world be a better place. I love being an educator. I am on the part-time faculty at MICA, the Maryland Institute College of Art, so I still teach, and that's an important part of my advocacy, but there's nothing like being able to actually stand on the floor of a legislature and advocate for people and to pass a piece of legislation. My research interest actually was late 19th century population statistics, and I was very interested in the census. I did my dissertation on the census of 1880 and the construction of American identity and how we use numbers to construct who we are, and also how, frankly, those numbers can be used to support white supremacy or can be used to oppose people over time. So using numbers and quantitative analysis to educate my community and educate my constituents is something that's very important to me. And so I think that makes me well suited, and why I often encourage more academics to not just go into the policy area, which a lot of us do, but to actually take on the complicated, messy business of governing.
Okay, wonderful. So you brought up policy. It's a wonderful segue. I'm going to turn over to Luke now, and he's going to ask you some questions about what will be going on this the session of the Maryland General Assembly. Thank you so much for talking with me.
All right, thank you.
So can you talk a little bit about your priorities for this session? Obviously, we're here with a big water bill announcement.
Yeah. Another priority was certainly, now that I'm on judicial proceedings, we'll be looking at public safety and the public safety reforms that are coming forward. On my legislative agenda, frankly, I'm going back to look at a lot of the bills that did not pass last year, and one of them has to do with, again, looking at our seniors and making sure that our senior centers are being properly funded, going back and looking at pediatric stroke and making sure that that is an issue that we can become aware of. But mostly I'm interested in learning the Senate. I'm interested in understanding what it's like to be one of 47 instead of one of 141. I'm interested in making sure that my constituents understand that they have a senator that is accessible, and to encourage more of them to come down to really be about facilitating, whether it's schools in my district or community groups, inviting them down. I see this as a year of building and of, just trying to figure out how we can do better.
You posted a pretty long Facebook post recently about the Johns Hopkins police force. The mayor has been advocating for this, the Senate president, Michael Bloomberg himself. There's a lot of powerful figures behind getting a private police force for Johns Hopkins. Can you summarize your thoughts here?
Yes. Privatizing public safety is not in anyone's interest across the board, whether it's Under Armour that's asking for it, whether it's Johns Hopkins University. We can't allow a process where something that is ultimately and fundamentally a public interest to simply have individuals who have the resources to simply buy their own safety. I guess to summarize, I would say that if we allow Johns Hopkins University to have its own public separate private police force, that where the police officers are the employees of Johns Hopkins University, then their original initial accountability is to their employer. Public safety, the officers of public safety, accountability should be to the general public. Johns Hopkins is a powerful entity, clearly. I think it should give us pause to allow the largest employer in the state of Maryland to have its own private police force. I think also I've done some research and find that one of the largest problems that Hopkins has on his campus is sexual assaults. And yet there's no discussion about that. We know already that so many of our colleges and universities are hiding that crime. A private police force would allow that to be hidden even further. But most importantly, these private police forces do not make the general public more safe. It may help a very small constituency, but it won't do anything to address the fundamental causes of the problems that Hopkins and other institutions are facing. And frankly, it's below us. We should be being innovative and creative and demanding better than simply more guns and more police that we know are failed policies. Johns Hopkins is better than that. I'm an alumni of Johns Hopkins. I'm going to demand that they use the same innovation that they use in surgery and in public health and apply that to crime and public safety. And I know if we do that and not be intellectually lazy, which is what this proposal is, then we could do something much better.
And then can you talk about what brought us out today? Obviously, this new legislation or yes. reintroduced legislation. Why is this important?
It's important because housing and economic stability is really core to so many of the challenges, or instability is so many of the challenges that Baltimore City faces, and that people should not lose their homes for unpaid water bills. We passed a temporary measure to allow a temporary ban on it. We see that it did help some people, and we want to help more by forever banning it. And I genuinely believe that 2019 is the year when we will do things that we never thought we could do before.
Senator, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Delegate Mosby, so first, can I get you to describe your district, the people and the places? How would they know if they were in the 40th district?
So I represent an amazing district. It's a large district, but it's also a microcosm of Baltimore City. It has like some of our strong historical cultural institutions and all the museums. It has the best park in the city of Baltimore and Druid Hill Park. It runs very deep north in like Hamden, Woodbury area, all the way down to like 95 and Morrill Park. It runs really far west, but with all of the great things, we also have many of our challenges. When we talk about the opioid crisis and how it's affecting some parts in the southern piece of the district, we talk about the heroin epidemic and how it's always been a stronghold over West Baltimore, particularly in Pennsylvania Avenue. We talk about violence that's connected to it. So, some other highlights is we have some amazing institutions and colleges and MICA and I think it's a very diverse district. I'm excited to represent it because, again, it's a microcosm of the city of Baltimore.
So what are your biggest hopes for its future? So when you think about future planning in your district, what you'd like to leave as a legacy that when you're eventually out of office, when everybody eventually gets out of office, tell me what you want your district to look like 10, 15 years from now.
I think economic development has always been an issue in some central places throughout the district, knowing that opportunity zones are coming down the pipeline, ensuring that there's strong minority participation in certain communities, particularly as it relates to, you know, leveraging the synergies of opportunity zones. So if I was able to look back on the district in 15 years, I would clearly say that I would hope to see economic development combined with a significant reduction in crime, significant increase in home ownership, and just bringing back the culture, bringing back the history, bringing back all the what we know the district has been and what the district can become.
So you've had a really busy few years. You started off as a member of city council, you ran for mayor, and while that didn't work out exactly as you had hoped, you quickly were appointed to the House of Delegates, and now you've just recently won your first election. So can you tell me a little bit about the differences in representing your constituency from being a city councilman to being a member of the House of Delegates? How have things changed? How are things different?
So it's so funny you asked me that. There's not a week that doesn't pass that someone doesn't say Councilman Mosby. throughout the district. Many people still kind of, for whatever reason, see me as the councilman or a council person in the district. What I will say is the difference is I really enjoy being on the city council because I had the opportunity of being directly face-to-face, boots on the ground to many of the issues. I knew where every pothole was. I knew where every abandoned building was. I knew where all the drug shops were setting up. I knew I was directly engaged with city services on a daily basis, where that's somewhat difficult to operate in that type of consistent manner from Annapolis in dealing with the demand of Annapolis. But what I will say is the benefit of Annapolis is, you know, if you're able to build the right coalitions and get behind the right issues, you can really drive sustainable, substantive impact, you know, from state law perspective, but then also as it relates to directing state resources to systemic issues. So, you know, that's the game that I'm looking to continue to push down in Annapolis, but I do miss, you know, that grind of being on the ground on a daily basis throughout the district in the 7.
Okay, my last question before I turn it over to Luke. You're what they call an Xennial, so that's the part of the generation that was it's born between Gen X and the Millennials. I've heard it described as a microgeneration that serves the ridge between the dissatisfaction of Gen X and the blithe optimism of the Millennials. So what are some examples of the generational differences you experience when working with your peers in Annapolis? How do you think the Maryland General Assembly would be different if the average age was closer to 40 than closer to 65 as it is now?
So clearly there's going to be a stronger understanding probably of social media. Definitely more pictures from an Instagram perspective. I think social media has become a huge part of delivering messages to constituencies. I think it's been really interesting how it's not just through text, but it's also through photography. You know, certain constituents of certain demographics want certain things. So younger constituents have been able to be more engaged in the whole political realm because some of these social media mediums. And, you know, I'm excited to be in the middle between the two.
Do you think that you've done a better job, perhaps, of reaching out to the younger constituents just for the kind of the virtue of being not quite 40 yet?
I think that, you know, I want to leverage it as I'd say I'm a chameleon, right? So I tell folks I can go to any corporate boardroom, I'll be able to communicate my point, you know, effectively try to drive change. But I could also do the same thing on any street corner in the city of Baltimore. So when you talk about being caught in between these two generations, I think it's kind of the same thing, being able to relate to both. And I've kind of always tried to leverage that as a strength in, you know, pushing and fighting for what's right for my community.
Because you spent a lot of time on your back, or your history, I've noticed you spent a lot of time with Baltimore City Youth. It was a big part of your community activism.
Yeah, I mean, because, you know, when we talk about changing the city of Baltimore and we talk about all the systemic issues that plague us, if we are not getting the future right, if we're not pouring all that we can pour into them so they can become as productive citizens and understand and know that there's a path of productivity for them in their life, then, you know, what are we really doing? I think that a lot of times I always give a description of, you know, if there was a bathtub full of water and it was our goal to get all the water out the tub, we can go up there with buckets and spoons and cups, but if the spigot is pouring out more water than we're able to take out, we're never going to address the problem. And what I see is the spigot is our children. So really trying to ensure that we meet all of their needs. So, and that's how we grow sustainable, a better Baltimore.
Wonderful. Thank you so much. So I'm going to turn it over to my co-host, Luke, and he's going to ask you about some of the policies that you'll be pushing through this legislative session. Thanks so much.
Delegate Mosby, wanted to talk with you about your legislative priorities for this session.
Well, clearly, you know, what we're here standing as it relates to the right to for water for Baltimoreans, ensuring that, you know, no longer will our vulnerable populations be impacted by this archaic practice of using someone's water bill to take their property in tax sale. You know, big initiatives that I also continue to push is, you know, one thing that, you know, I will always push, will be very challenging down in Annapolis, is going after the manufacturers of lead paint, understanding and knowing that for decades they knew that this was poisoning places like Baltimore City. We have it all in their intercompany documentation. And they continue to sell. And today, you know, with all the impact, knowing there's a direct correlation between our educational system and the dysfunction there and of children learning ability to the criminal justice system, there's a direct correlation to lead paint poisoning. The fact that they have never paid 1 cent to mediate this the situation is just unacceptable. So that's something that I'm going to continue to do as it relates to market share liability down in Annapolis. One big bill that I'm excited about is the REDEEM Act, which is a huge bill of going after the practice of expungement for past criminal convictions. We understand that, know that, you know, it's completely unfair for folks to wear scarlet letter on their chest for the rest of their life because they've made some criminal transgression 5, 10, 15, 20 years ago. That was a huge push of mine when I was on the city council with Ban the Box. And then there's a lot of other things that we have around criminal justice reform that I'm excited about. I'm going to continue to push the HBCU issue. I think the fact that knowing that the court has ruled that the duplicative programming has been a problem for HBCUs, we understand and know that it's directly impacted funding, that's impacted their growth, the fact that the state now has a countersuit or is appealing the decision, you know, I'm going to continue to push to ensure that we try to clear that up as quickly as possible. And the due process was already served, and HBCUs are granted what they deserve. And then lastly, you know, what I will continue to talk about is crime. Like, there's no secret that the crisis of Baltimore City right now is directly related to crime. And to me, that should be the sole purpose of everyone in the state of Maryland. So goes Baltimore, so goes the state of Maryland. And the fact that we are seeing 300 murders every single year in the past 4 years is just completely unacceptable.
My colleague Dan Rodericks wrote a column recently in which he listed a bunch of names of people who might run for mayor. Your name was on the list. what's your reaction to that? Is that something you're thinking about again?
I don't know if Dan Rodericks is a fan or what. I'm not sure. Right now I'm focused on this session. I think that, again, we need all hands on deck around this crime issue. You know, there's many things that are being floated out there about what should be the delegation priorities. I can't see how, you know, we're not spending all of our collective time to ensure that we do as much to drive crime down in the city. And, you know, this idea of more policing has never worked. It's almost just rhetoric at this point. We need to identify the programs and systems to go after this incubator that's creating criminals in our city, that's projecting on this criminal culture in our city, and, you know, cure this crisis that we have right now.
Great. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Okay. That's all we have this week on Roughly Speaking Government Edition. But we'll be back next week and every week until we sine die.
Thanks for joining us. And if you like what you heard, please subscribe via iTunes or wherever else podcasts are found. And while times change, the need for quality journalism doesn't. So please consider subscribing to the Baltimore Sun at www.baltimoresun.com. Thanks, and see you next week.